When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
If you have a problem with it, build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back, Crossover Podcast. Glad you could join us post-All-Star edition. Just coming off All-Star weekend in Chicago. Not as cold as I thought it was going to be in Chicago. Kind of a balmy 35 degrees for the most part. No issues there. Only the faint of heart and the weak skin avoid Chicago. But that transitions me right into my guest this week, Rohan Nadkarni, staff writer over at Sports Illustrated. And Melissa Rowland covers the Lakers for SI.com. What's up, guys? Thanks for coming into the LA branch of my podcast studio.
Well, Chris, welcome to Los Angeles, my hometown, my newly adopted hometown, where it was a balmy 65 degrees and sunny all weekend. You know, it's been a while since we've done this podcast. As you know, I like to give the listeners a little update on what's going on in my life every time we do this. I adopted a dog. His name is Boba. It's like he rescued me. I didn't rescue him, you know, and I'm growing out a mustache.
Still, okay. The mustache is creepy.
Yeah.
It's understandable in November with the whole Movember thing.
I see. But
now,
out of context, February mustache is bad.
Now you're just like auditioning for To Catch a Predator.
Right. Okay. Cool. Very, very current reference.
Well, can we get, first of all, I watch those replays on CNBC or whatever it is all the time. MSNBC all the time. Yeah. It's great. Well, ask the female in the room. Melissa, can we get a verdict on the mustache?
You know, Rohan and I just met recently. Yeah, I'm right, not going to weigh in too heavily on that, but I do have to ask what inspired it.
It's just a look. I live in East Los Angeles, dude. This is normal. This is every day.
It's hipster.
Yeah,
it's hipster
sure. Whatever you want to call it.
Without putting Rohan on the spot, how many people do you think can pull off a mustache? Like, I can name two. Tom Selleck.
Tom Selleck. Okay.
And Burt Reynolds could.
Burt Reynolds. Okay.
Those are the only two people I have ever seen or known.
Gotcha. That
my father had a mustache for a while. It wasn't a good look.
No? Okay, fair enough.
Charlie Chaplin.
There we go.
All the way back to Charlie Chaplin.
That's how far back
we have to go. Three people, only one of which is alive, right? And then... all of these 70s.
Well, both of you should spend some more time in India, and I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Yeah, let's
put that on the old bucket list.
There we go.
All right. Lot to get to this week. As always, subscribe to the podcast over on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. Rate, review it. It's very helpful to keep this podcast going every single week. It's easy. Check it out on Apple Podcasts. All right. So, All-Star Weekend in the books. And I got to say, I've been to like 10 or 15 All-Star games. Most entertaining All-Star game that I have seen. The rule changes, which were widely panned when they first came out, were extremely effective. You had players competing at the end of quarters. You had a fourth quarter that was ultra competitive from start to finish. You had coaches' challenges in the fourth quarter. You had near technical fouls in the fourth quarter because of so much complaining to the referees. And while I didn't love the finish, I'd like to see them tweak the rules for next year so it doesn't end on a free throw. I love the All-Star game. Melissa, what did you think of the changes the NBA made and how it all played out?
I thought it was great. The first three quarters were kind of business as usual. guys not playing any defense, a lot of open slam dunks, open three-pointers. Nobody wants to see that. People watch the All-Star game because they want to see the best sort of pickup game in the world, amongst the best basketball players in the world. So you don't want to watch guys just sprint up and down the court for open shots. The fourth quarter, however, was where it got really interesting. I agree with you. The referees need to find a way to stay out of the way. For it to end on a free throw was just really anticlimactic to what was the most exciting All-Star game maybe ever.
It's not even I don't even blame the referees for it ending on a free throw. Somebody else put this out there, and I hate taking credit for it. It's not mine, but like instead of you have to call the foul, right?
Yeah,
like
you. I think it was like the other team loses a point.
The other team loses a point. Yeah. Like that, Ron. That's the best way to go. Instead of just having Anthony Davis make one free throw to end the game, I'm still like, and I was kind of running around there. I would have loved to have asked James Harden like why he passed for the first time in James Harden passing history. Right. Right? But he had a wide open shot and he threw the ball out to, of all people, Chris Paul.
I was listening to a podcast and they said he's so used to whipping it out to the open corner three that he just forgot. You know.
But you know, is he so used to that? Like in that context, like James Harden finishes that play every single time in their game.
I mean, just to, you know, going off what Melissa said, I thought that was what was so perfect about this game was that because of the unfamiliarity that all these players had with each other, the fact that it was a pickup game, it wasn't, you know, let's run our team's offense down the stretch, it made it that much more fun. Like, we had LeBron and Giannis going one-on-one, like genuinely going at each other one-on-one, in a way that they wouldn't do in a regular season game. I thought that was the most fun part. You know, LeBron isn't really going to isolate on Giannis at the top of a key in a regular season game. That's just, they know that that's not good offense, whatever, blah, blah, blah. In an All-Star game, it's like, no, I want to prove that I'm better than you. There's like the theater of it. And that, to me, was what was the most fun part is because of just the unfamiliarity of it, I think the players were getting swept up in the new ending and everything. We saw those things that we always want to see from an All-Star game. And you could tell that just how sweaty everyone was at the end of the fourth quarter, just how much effort they were really putting into it.
I mean, why not take the refs out of it? Why not just have, like, plain basketball pickup rules where the players call their own fouls?
And
that would be awful.
Exactly.
Except Harden.
You could, like, I think LeBron said this after the game where he's like, you know, we get fouled a lot harder in pickup games and you can't call it.
Exactly.
Circumstances. I mean, I think that's when it gets like the dangerous point.
Yeah,
you see guys.
Also, Kyle Lowry would have been doing all kinds of goon stuff.
Kyle Lowry was my favorite.
Oh my god,
was he really trying to take a charge against LeBron?
The charge he took against Harden, by the way, was maybe this is the most absurd statement I'm ever going to say. The riskiest play in All-Star game history because Harden hit that three. That would have been the end of the game.
Yeah,
it was incredible,
and that's why the man is an NBA champion.
That's right. Right. Yes.
Look, I'm glad they did these, the quote-unquote Elam
was
rules.
Nick Nurse point shaving, by the way? What was he doing with that lineup in the end of at the end of the fourth quarter?
Don't ever question Nick Nurse. Nick Nurse knows
Nick
what he's doing
Nurse,
out there.
Why was Kemba Walker on the floor for a defensive possession at the end of the game? You have Jimmy Butler on the bench.
Maybe you're overthinking it a little bit.
The coaching decisions that Nick Nurse made, man, let me tell
but
you.
But I'm sitting there.
It's hard when the other team isn't missing their best player, isn't it, Nick Nurse?
I'm sitting there. And, oh, yeah, that's why they won the champion. Yeah, you're right. That's 100% what the Raptors
I was firing off some hot takes, man. I was upset.
The one of the other hilarious side points was, like, you see Frank Vogel and Nick Nurse, like, drawing up plays. Like,
yeah.
Either of them thought we'd be, like, drawing up our best play at the end of these games. Like,
totally. Yeah.
I have to imagine the refs were a little nervous, too. They were probably like, you know, how serious
Mark Davis is out there like, what am I doing? Why am I, like, getting yelled at by Chris Paul right now? Like, what is happening in this? Why is James Harden in my ear at the end of an All-Star? I thought this was like a free vacation.
Yeah.
You know, an honor to referee the All-Star game? I don't know. The rule works, though. The Elam rules, they work. They'll be back next year, a few tweaks. I think it's made – like, I tweet this out. I think after – every sports league has tried to fix their All-Star games, like baseball with the whole World Series home field advantage, which was dumb. Basketball's made tweaks. I think the NBA finally got it right. I think they have figured out how to make these All-Star rules work. Anything else from All-Star weekend? Like, I continue to ride the train of getting rid of the dunk contest. I have no use for it whatsoever. It was pretty good. Like,
it's
Derek
for
Jones,
kids. It's for kids.
If it's for kids, here's what I would replace it with. I would replace it with a competition of King of the Court. Like, everyone that played basketball.
Can you realistically
Hold on. Everyone that played basketball as a kid grew up playing King of the Court. You know, one-on-one, games to one, next man up, next man off. You put a big cash prize at the end of it. And I guarantee you, because there'd be real money involved and because these guys all want to be known as the best one-on-one player in the NBA, that there would be big name stars competing in that. Like James Harden would play in a King of the Court competition.
He has too much to lose.
I'm with Melissa on this one.
Game, too.
I don't know. I would love to see that, Chris. I think you're 100% right. No guy is going to put themselves on the line like that.
I do not think we need to get rid of the dunk contest. Let's dial that back a little bit. Like, if you were a kid watching that, you're probably like, this is awesome. You probably don't even remember who won or you don't care. Listen, it pains me to say it, and I just interviewed him because he's getting his jersey retired. We do need to talk about Dwayne Wade and his, like, some shady judging tactics that were going on for that last Aaron Gordon dunk. There was clearly some kind of agreement made amongst the judges. He seemed to back out at the last second. That's my very amateur reading of the situation. Whether they, even if they just introduced 9.5s or something like that, I also think it does not matter that you don't win the dunk contest. No one really remembers that Zach LaVine won that one. They just remember Aaron Gordon's dunk over the mascot. I think that's really what matters. That's what you want from the dunk contest. One or two dunks that you can definitively say, I'm going to remember this for a long time. And that's what this competition was memorable. That's all you can ask for.
I agree. You like the dunks I remember historically. I remember Blake Griffin dunking over a car.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I remember the Vince Carter elbow in the cylinder.
Gerald Green birthday cake dunk. That was underrated.
Yes, underrated. Gerald Green. I have no interest in seeing this stuff. Maybe I'm past that age.
Yeah, you're old and bitter and gray. We get it.
Yeah, all those things. Yes. Yeah. The one with the mustache. Okay?
Yes,
just
that's
to be
right.
clear. Right? But whatever. The only other topic that I wanted to get to on All-Star Weekend, the NBA renamed the All-Star MVP for Kobe Bryant. And we've seen a lot of honoring of Kobe. We'll see even more honoring, I'm sure, in the future. But has the NBA done enough at this point as far as, appreciating Kobe? I know some people want to see them change the logo to Kobe Bryant. There were T-shirts going around All-Star Weekend of a new logo with Kobe. It should be pointed out, the NBA has never acknowledged that Jerry West is the logo. Even though he is, they have never acknowledged it. But should the NBA, is this enough? Have they done enough at this point?
Why not make him the logo? Jerry West has come out multiple times saying that he doesn't want to be the logo, that he never wanted to be the logo. Why not give that to Kobe?
Or he wants to get paid for it.
You know, that's a great way to memorialize him. He'll be everywhere. He'll be the NBA. And I think everybody wants to see that. It'll be a beautiful tribute to him. Why not do that?
Well, I mean, my only counter is that, you know, you then have to dissect the imperfections of Kobe. And you have to go back to 2003 and everything that happened there. And look, nobody's flawless, but that might be a tougher sell than just the All-Star MVP. The All-Star MVP, it just points directly to Kobe's, you know, All-Star resume and all his talents. You make him the literal face of the NBA, there will be some objections. There will be women's groups and justifiably, too, based on, I mean, it was 17 years ago now, but, you know, I didn't cover it, but I was just getting started then, and people would remember that.
Definitely. And I also think that, like, the All-Star Game MVP thing, I think a lot of people had that idea, and it makes complete and perfect sense, and I like that a lot. If anything, what I would like to see the NBA do is use their platform to continue some of the things Kobe was passionate about the last few years of his life, whether that's involvement in youth sports, involvement in women's sports, and that goes for the NBA, that goes for Nike. I mean, we're talking huge, huge corporations that have a lot of money at their disposal that can affect change in areas that he was passionate about. And I think to me that would mean more than even naming a trophy after him is using your resources to kind of, you know, further the causes that he was passionate about that can, you know, make a genuine, tangible impact on people's lives. So that's what I would like to see. I mean, and I wrote about this, I think, that week, but, you know, I think Nike, like, immediately sold out of Kobe gear.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if Nike didn't profit off of the interest in Kobe right now and use that money instead to, you know, donate it to the Mambacita Academy. Like, there's just so many things that I think the NBA and Kobe's, you know, endorsement partners can do on that level that I think people kind of don't think about, or maybe it feels crass to say, but to me, that would be so much more meaningful than even making him the logo, because then you are, in honor of him, you are making a tangible impact on so many more lives. So that's what I would like to see.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, why not do both? I think back to your point sort of about making Kobe the face of the league, I think you can have somebody be the face of the league who doesn't have a crystal clean, squeaky clear past. I think Kobe, I mean, you saw the impact of him. I've thought about this a lot in Los Angeles and maybe across the nation. I mean, if somebody abruptly died right now, who would have a greater impact? Who would leave so many people crying? Who would touch so many people like Kobe? And I think that's really powerful. And Kobe stood for a mentality. He stood not only for, you know, multiple championships, but just like a work ethos, a work ethic. And I think that in and of itself is, you know, something the NBA wants to stand behind.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that argument. And one thing Ryan Rucco and I talked about a few weeks back was, like, the NBA is not used to losing people, not just tragically, but like the 50s Celtics are all still alive.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's been tragedies here or there, you know, people passing away a little bit early, but the NBA really got kickstarted in the 1950s and Bill Russell's still alive. We saw him at All-Star Weekend. Tommy Heinsohn's still alive. I know that better than anybody. Bob Cousy, you know, still alive. I mean, all these greats from that era are still, so when somebody dies, it's not, even as if it's not abruptly, it's still shocking. It's a jolt for the NBA. So you don't see that all that often.
I saw Bill Russell going through security at the Charlotte airport last weekend after All-Star Weekend was done. And I was like, does no one here know who this is? This is, let this man through.
Does he need TSA pre-check at that point?
Yeah, come on. I made him get out of his wheelchair. I was like, it's Bill Russell. It was crazy.
He should be able to ID just by his face.
Exactly.
Just by his face. All right, so let's talk about the second half of the season, which really isn't the second half of the season. It's like the final third of the season. But all attention is going to be on Los Angeles as the Clippers and Lakers enter their stretch run. I saw the Clippers play in Boston about a week, just right before the All-Star break, actually.
Oh, are you from Boston?
I am.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that. No, I didn't.
They don't have mustaches.
I see. Got it. I was going to say something else.
No, but
they don't have a lot of things in Boston.
The Clippers looked okay. I mean, Paul George went out in halftime of that game with a hamstring injury. Patrick Beverley didn't play, but they look okay. And we've seen a lot of the Lakers, but I guess the question is going into the final third is which one of these teams is in a better position? We're all kind of sort of anticipating a hallway series, though we can get to the potential disruptors and all that. But Melissa, which team is in better position right now, the Clippers or the Lakers, as we kind of barrel towards the playoffs?
Oh, I think the Lakers by far. This is a revenge season for LeBron. This is a guy who took both Miami and Cleveland to the finals 8 years in a row. Then he missed the playoffs last year. He desperately wants to get back, and he desperately wants to go far and win this team a championship. And now, after Kobe died, he has even more on his back. He has even more that he's playing for. He has even more inspiration. I think LeBron, AD, that's a team that really is going to go far, and I don't think the Clippers can really compare right now.
Rowan, what do you think?
So it's tricky. I mean, I guess not to be like theoretical about it, but I guess it depends what you mean by position. Like the Lakers are the one seed, and they've been trying all year, and they want to win, and I do think that kind of stuff is important. This isn't a unique thought. I think a lot of people around the league feel this way. The Clippers are treating this season as if this is like their third year of a championship window where they're like, we're not going to try our hardest every night. We're going to sit some guys to the point where we haven't really seen them at full strength yet. But when you just look at their rosters, I do think that you can make the case that the Clippers are in a little bit of a better position for a deeper playoff run in the sense that, well, their guys don't have a lot of wear and tear. They seem to have a little bit more, you know, lineup positional flexibility than the Lakers. It's splitting hairs at this point, right? Because what I've always come back to is in the last 8 minutes of a close playoff game, who's going to have the best five on the floor? And if your five includes LeBron and Anthony Davis, it's just going to be really hard to beat that five. So, I mean, I think I'm going to say Clippers right now just because I think they were, I don't even remember who my finals pick was. That was months ago. That was many mojitos ago. I'll just say that I think that I like the Clippers a little bit more today, if only because I think there's something to say about the fact that maybe they'll be fresher for the playoff run. Kawhi, on any given night, I think still often looks like the best player in the league. But they're very close, and they're a lot closer than, you know, like the Marcus Morris trade, I think, was a really good trade for the Clippers, but the two teams are still very close. It wasn't like one move is going to put one of them way over the top of the other.
Yeah, I think it's a coin flip, too. I do lean a little bit more towards the Clippers just because, look, I buy the inspirational part for the Lakers, though I think that comes with a certain pressure, too, that that could affect them in deeper in the playoffs. But the Clippers are less flawed, it feels like, mm-hmm. than the Lakers. The Lakers, even against Kawhi and Paul George, are the two best players on the floor in LeBron and AD, but the Darren Collison stay-in-retirement thing killed them. Like, that was a body blow to that team, because you can make an argument that if Collison had signed there, and assuming he was in any kind of shape, which mm-hmm. I guess we don't really know, he would have been the starting point guard in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just fits what the Lakers do much more than Rondo and Avery Bradley and Vic Caruso and all those guys there. So if they had been able to get Darren Collison, I would have been much more excited about the Lakers' chances, because he makes three-point shots, he defends, he just does. He fits that system with which they played. And without him, like, I don't know if Reggie Jackson becomes available. I think if he does, it's another street fight between the Clippers and Lakers to mm-hmm. go and get him.
Please don't street fight over Reggie Jackson.
Well, look,
he could have some value as a third guy.
He's 6'3" point guard who can make shots.
Well, let me just, to your point, and I remember going to the Christmas Day game, and, you know, there was like a 3-minute stretch in the fourth quarter where the Lakers play Rondo. So Rondo's on the floor, Kuzma's on the floor, because he was having a great shooting night that night. AD, LeBron, and I think, you know, it was KCP for a little bit, Bradley for a little bit. My biggest issue with the Lakers, and to your point about signing someone like Collison, is I don't think that Vogel is fully confident in the five guys he wants on the floor at the end of a game yet. You know, the Lakers have been so good. They haven't been in a ton of close games. A lot of times they go matchup dependent, right? Some nights it's like Dwight's closing in the fourth quarter, and Dwight's been playing great. Other nights, you know, they go AD, you know, at the five, which makes a lot of sense. That's what we all thought they'd do at the beginning of the season. The Clippers, I think, have their identity. They know exactly the five guys they want on the floor at the end of a game. And, you know, maybe they'll go offense, defense for Lou and Pat, something like that. The Lakers, I think, are still trying to figure that out. Now, KCP, or Kuzma, rather, who's kind of been like a, should we have traded him for Morris? I think there's some debate about how good he is. Do the Lakers overvalue him? He's done really well when he's played alongside AD and LeBron. I mean, that's not shocking. A lot of guys do. But they can manufacture good lineups with those three guys on the floor. It just means AD's going to have to be at the five. But I don't think Vogel, that day when he was questioned about it, I mean, he wasn't thrilled with the line of questioning when people asked him, why is Rondo on the floor? But it gave me the sense that in that tight moment, in the highest competition, highest stakes, I don't know if today he's convinced. I know that it's these five guys. You guys have to deal with it. Because all the great teams, or all the championship teams that have won over the last few years, that's what they had. They had that one lineup. And I don't know if the Lakers are... They have it. They have the potential for it. But I don't think they're confident either way who it's going to be.
I think the Lakers are banking on the fact that playoff Rondo is going to be extremely different than regular season
Rondo. That's a real thing. Like, playoff
Absolutely.
Rondo... Absolutely. I've seen that close to personal. That is a real thing.
That is a real thing. I mean, think back to the 2018 NBA Finals. LeBron is on the podium, and he's talking about how the most important thing going into any Finals series is playing alongside guys with high IQs. He points to three guys during that time: Rondo, Draymond Green, and Iguodala. Now he's playing alongside Rondo, and I think he's really excited to see what's going to happen in the playoffs with him. And I think everybody, including Vogel, the other night, Rondo had a great night. He's had moments of brilliance throughout the season and moments where he's been absolutely terrible. But I think both Vogel and LeBron believe that when it comes playoff time, that he's going to be a huge piece.
That just seems like a wild strategy to me. I don't know. I'm here for TNT Rondo and playoff Rondo, and that Bulls series that he had a couple years ago when they were going against the Celtics in the first round.
They would have won that series.
Crazy. They would have won that series if he didn't get hurt. But that to me is just a wild strategy to bank on, where it's a guy on your team who's been inconsistent at best is going to be the guy who turns the tide. I don't know. I'm not saying it's impossible or that they're not close. I just think that I'm just surprised for a team of that caliber this late in the season to not really know definitively these are the best five we want to put on the floor at the end of a game. Because I think you go down the list of every other contender or pseudo contender, they know those five guys.
Yeah, and this is where I think the Clippers, they've still got issues with that second unit rebounding, and, you know, maybe they get somebody else to compliment Harrell, though Harrell had a monster game the other night against Boston. and he's a terrific scorer. But like, I don't see the same lineup question marks. The Clippers more about health.
It's right.
Like, can they get, and Doc Rivers said as much last week, like, can they get, you know, all five of their top guys and their bench on the floor, you know, for the next 25 games, getting chemistry? Like, and if they can do that, I think that no matter where they finish in the standings, like, we all know, if the Clippers wound up with home court advantage over the Lakers, it's still not home court advantage.
No.
Like,
right.
It's still Lakers fans at Staples Center cheering for the Lakers. It's not home court advantage. They go into the playoffs with that mindset. So it almost doesn't matter what seed they finish in with the Clippers, as long as they are at full strength. Whereas with the Lakers, you know, I go back and forth on Rondo. I see the numbers bear it out. Like, the weaknesses there when he's out there on the floor. I think Davis will play that five spot a lot, but that puts Kuzma in a position of influence there. And he has just continues to be erratic. I mean, I was watching him the last couple of weeks. I mean, he has one good game, then he goes 2-for-8 against the Rockets, and then he's back with another good game. It's just, you know, at this point, I'm not confident that Kyle Kuzma can develop the type of chemistry with this group to be really impactful in the postseason.
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to throw this out there because I talked about Kuzma a little bit. I meant to look this up last night and I forgot. I don't remember the exact combination, but it's something like Bradley, KCP, Kuzma, Davis, LeBron. That lineup has not played a ton together, but in their minutes, they've been outstanding. So I that's a group I want to see more of because I think it could be a closing five for the Lakers.
But it seems to be that we all agree on that the Lakers have lineup questions. The Clippers have chemistry questions. I'd rather go into a final series with lineup questions over chemistry questions.
But do you think it's chemistry? And I want to finish, but do you think it's chemistry or, like, Boston last year had chemistry questions. Philadelphia this year has chemistry questions. I think that it's more like consistency questions with the Clippers. Like, I think they're, you know, there was that report about, like, they're not happy about the Kawhi stuff.
Right.
I feel like that was kind of overblown. Like, it all came from a Harrell, it stemmed from a Harrell kind of comment about we're not a good team right now. I just get the sense that they're okay. They just need time together. I don't get the sense, I guess, that they don't like each other.
That's fair. But I think the Lakers really like each other. Mm. And I think that really, really helps down the line. This is a team that goes out to dinner.
Right.
This is a team that actually, right before the playoffs, they were all texting each other saying, we're going to miss you. Like, is there a way we can hang out before guys leave? I mean, this team
is... We do that at SI. You know?
Yeah, yeah,
we all have that. Like, when I leave this stand,
I'll
text both
text
of you.
I'll text you guys. I just want to throw it out there. Like, this is a super hot, like, debate show take. The Clippers winning the finals this year would be, I legitimately think, not great for the NBA. I just want to throw that out there. I don't think Adam Silver would be thrilled if the Clippers won the finals this year.
Why?
Just because of the like wanton disrespect they've treated the regular season with. Just like, yeah, no, like, we don't really care. One night this guy will play, one night this guy will play. All right. Like, their success is kind of like, unfortunately, kind of proves
guys,
like how unimportant
here,
this is.
You guys are out here doing these games more than I do. Isn't this just a Kawhi thing? Like, everybody else is legitimately injured. Like, and I think Kawhi might be legitimately injured too. But like, this is all Kawhi, right? Like the disrespect, the quote disrespect.
I mean, yes and no. Like I think they're extra cautious. I think they're maybe one or two degrees more cautious than most other teams because they can afford to be. That's what it comes down to. When you have that much talent, you know, I'm not saying that this has happened. But one night the Heat might be more willing to push Jimmy Butler because seeding is more important to them than the Clippers would be Paul George.
Totally.
Because they're like, we don't care where we enter. We just need all these guys healthy in the playoffs.
But that's nothing new. The Spurs have always done that. I mean, Popovich would sit guys left and right, and that would upset the league. But, hey, he'd win championships. And when it comes down to it, that's all that matters.
I mean, I don't disagree that, you know, best thing for the NBA will be the Lakers winning. Or at the very least, a Lakers. Lakers Celtics probably still remains the gold standard for a potential finals matchup. But Lakers Bucks would be good, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Giannis being involved in it and getting him kind of that star moment. But yeah, I mean, the Lakers are the biggest story, and having them in the finals, I think would be huge. But like, before they get to, you know, that hallway series, like, who is the biggest disruptor out there? Because the Western Conference playoffs from start to finish are going to be really tough. Like, from, you know, that 1-8 matchup all the way on up. I mean, who is the biggest threat, Rohan, to both teams in the conference?
So I was on record saying the Rockets were going to lose in the first round. That was before they went all small ball, and now Russ is their only non-shooter, and I weirdly like them more.
They doubled down couple of days.
I mean,
Damari Carroll,
yeah,
Jeff Green.
They basically realized you can't play Russ in a center at the same time anymore. which is like actually brilliant forward thinking. But I have to stick to my guns, so I won't say the Rockets. I've always been a big believer in the Nuggets, but I have not gotten a great vibe from them this season. I mean, they've been playing really well lately considering all the injuries they've had. I like the moves they made at the deadline. I might have to go. This is going to sound nuts. I think I may have to go with the Jazz. The Jazz have been like sneaky great for a couple months. Hear me out. If the Jazz get the 2 or 3 seed, which is not impossible for them right now. I mean, everyone's really bunched up there. I think they're going to have a great home court advantage. I think that they kind of have the lineup flexibility that's going to help them in a lot of these games. Gobert is like still one of the best defensive centers in the league, and he's been in an uncomfortable position the last couple of times because they had to go up against the Rockets. If they avoid that matchup, I think he can play well in a series against one of the LA teams. Do I believe in them as a disruptor? Do I believe in any team as a disruptor? I don't know. Like, I think it's going to be Lakers Clippers at the end of the day, you know, depending on how the bracket falls, I guess. But I weirdly have more trust in them than Houston and Denver at this point. I it's just a gut thing. I wish I could explain it to you with more confidence, but I've picked Denver to win the finals the last 2 years. But I don't really have a ton of faith in them. I mean, we've seen the Lakers handle them pretty easily a couple times. And between Utah and Houston, I don't think Houston's offense is going to have the same level of success in the playoffs. So that is how I end up on Utah.
I'm definitely going to go with Houston. They gave the Lakers fits in their last game.
I think the Lakers tried too much to play like Houston. I don't think they would do that again. But that's fair. That's fair.
That's definitely a good point. Yeah. But I think the Lakers just are going to have a really tough time defending them. I mean, you slack on players. They have 5 guys on the court at any given moment who can shoot a 3. James Harden averages 40 points a game. Russell Westbrook is a guy who's averaged triple-doubles in past seasons. I mean, you go out on defenders. Westbrook beats you with his quick first step and penetrates to the basket. They just didn't have an answer to stop them.
Yeah, well, I buy Houston. Houston's success depends entirely on Westbrook. It's not P.J. Tucker at the 5. It's not James Harden. It's Westbrook. Because what the Jazz did in that first game against them with Rudy Gobert guarding him at the center position is exactly what teams are going to do going forward.
Yes.
They're going to dare Russ to make 3-pointers, which he hasn't all season, and mid-range jump shots, which
for
he
years.
Has. Well, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Well, he's never been a consistent 3-point shooter. They're going to dare him to beat him from the outside. Now, against the Jazz in that matchup, which was like the best regular season game I've seen all season, he made mid-range shots. He was banking shots in. He shot a high percentage. So if he can continue to do that, okay, I'm willing to buy the Rockets because they're physical. They can switch everything, which is important in today's NBA. And if Westbrook is making shots, that's big. But, I mean, we've spent like years talking about how that mid-range jump shot is the lowest percentage shot in the NBA. Like, so if Russ is going to stand out there and shoot mid-range jump shots over Rudy Gobert and make them, or Anthony Davis or Nikola Jokic or anybody else out there, okay, because if he's not making them, all of a sudden you're allowing a great defensive big man, whether it's Gobert or Davis or even Jokic, to just play zone. Like, he can just stand in the middle of the paint and be this kind of wall against teams. And I don't know if I have confidence yet that Russ is going to make all those shots.
I agree. And I love Russell Westbrook. I want an NBA to exist where someone like Russell Westbrook can be one of the best players. My confidence in him has dwindled after the last 2 first round playoff exits that he had, where he was a net negative for the Thunder. I mean, last year the Thunder were being carried by Paul George. They were negative in the minutes that it was just Russ on the court. And to his credit, the partnership with Harden's gotten better than I've thought. And he's been on this crazy hot streak the last, you know, 6 weeks or so. I don't want to get caught up in those 6 weeks compared to the last 2 or 3 years of his career. I do think and I give Daryl Morey a lot of credit for realizing, you know, I think Russ and Capella, that duo, had a 2.2 net rating together, which isn't great. I mean, it's certainly not like contender level. And he realized, like, we just can't really play him with the center, so we're going to go and get another wing guy and make Russ our de facto big, or the guy who can't shoot, really, is what it is. And like that Lakers game, and I think Vogel said it after the game, they got so caught up in trying to post up Anthony Davis, they just got out of their offense completely. that's probably the Rockets' biggest advantage, is just Jedi mind tricking teams into being like, oh, you're going to have to do these things you don't normally do because you think that's the smart thing. But I think once teams kind of realize, wait, let's just do what we do and we can have success against this, they'll be better off. And that's what makes me nervous about that.
They would just, I mean, you guys, they were just sloppy with those entry passes to Davis in that game.
Yeah, and like, it was obviously they were doing a thing that they don't normally do, right? They were just like it just looked awkward. It looked like they were like a practice, like this is what they were trying to do for the first time.
I agreed with, I mean, I thought it was kind of crazy when they traded Capella basically for Robert Covington. But I see it. Like, I see that the ceiling for this Rockets team is a lot higher with this group than it was with the other. Like, the floor might even be lower.
Yeah.
Like, they could, if they got beaten five games in the first round, that wouldn't surprise me.
Well, yeah.
But if they went to the conference finals, that
Well, the variance me. Is just going to be super high because it's going to be come down to the three-point shooting, right? Yeah. But so are you saying Houston is your biggest disruptor?
No,
I'm not
no,
letting
I'm
you
actually,
off the hook.
I'm actually, I'm sort of with you on the on Utah. It's taken the Jazz like 5 months to figure Mike Conley out. Like,
I still need to see a little bit more. I love Mike Conley.
I need to see a little bit more, but Mike Conley, he's not like some guy coming out of nowhere, right?
Right.
He's had years of experience going deep in the playoffs with Memphis. He comes to the Jazz. He has a hard time early on with his shot. It wasn't going. He has a hard time early on fitting into a completely different way of playing. It was ground and pound there in Memphis for years. Now he's playing with Donovan Mitchell, and he's playing with Joe Ingles, different types of guys. And that took him a little bit while. Then he got injured, and all of a sudden, kind of all hell broke loose. But as he's come back, I think Quinn Snyder did the right thing in bringing him off the bench early on, and he's got some rhythm going here. And I'm just a believer that Mike Conley is good enough that if he can get up to like 90-95% of what he was last year with Memphis, that's a really freaking good team. Like, that you got Conley and Mitchell in the backcourt, Gobert, backstop in the middle. Ingles has been great all season long. They seem to have finally figured out how not to play with a Derek Favors type power forward out there. I mean, like that. Look, Melissa, that was a team that coming into the year, they were viewed as kind of a dark horse finals candidate. And I think they're after a rough start, they're kind of back to being that team.
I think that's fair, but I still think the Rockets are the team. And
she's like, I think that's fair, but I disagree. <with them. laughs>
I think that's fair, but I think you're wrong.
Yeah.
No, but I do think that the Rockets are the team that. And I think Rohan brought up a good point, too. Part of it is that they just throw teams off. And that if there is a series against the Lakers, that half that series is going to be with the Lakers trying to figure out how to defend them. And they might figure it out. And, yes, there is a lot of variance from the three-point line, but I think they have the best chance of getting past them.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be an exciting series if that winds up that way. I mean, I'm not sure which team they have a better shot at, like, who are the Rockets better at knocking off? The Clippers or the Lakers?
That is a good question.
I want say the Lakers. Just for
I think I might say the Clippers, only because I think AD would be the difference in a series against the Rockets. I think he could really find a way to dominate that series. If the Clippers have one maybe question mark, it's size.
Yeah, but against the Rockets, it doesn't matter. Like,
it doesn't matter.
Could
but
go small
but
and play
hear me out
at five.
Hear me out, but. Then that lends itself to the series being played at Houston's style, and Houston dictates the terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is what would scare me in that series. I think a team that beats Houston is going to do it because they won't bend to Houston's style of play.
Mm.
And if a team finds itself doing that, that's maybe when the Rockets could get frisky. That's just the way I look at it. But
frisky, huh?
Yeah,
that's
frisky.
Here that's we go. The adjective
yeah.
we're choosing.
Yes, there? With the mustache.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let me look at the Eastern Conference for a second. The Bucks are 46-8. They're running away with the conference. There's no competitor to them right now. 21-5 on the road, 25-3 at home. They've just been dominant all season long. But they go into this postseason with some legitimate pressure. I mean, the Giannis contract extension is looming over them. There is a shocking amount of teams in the league that remain quietly confident that Giannis is not going to sign that extension. I had a conversation with one GM who I know will kick the tires on Giannis, who said to me, he's like, you know, they get to the finals and they lose. Giannis can say, well, I took this team as far as I could. They get to the finals and win. Giannis can say, well, I won a championship in Milwaukee. I've done it all for you. So maybe that's just wishful thinking on the part of these teams. But there's just a lot of pressure on this Bucks team. So if you're Milwaukee right now, and you basically go 12 deep with some of the move you made with Marvin Williams, 12 deep, legitimately,
okay,
12
okay,
guys
okay.
they can play. I mean, there was interest in Sterling Brown,
all right,
like
all
if
right.
they had bought him out. Melissa, I'll go to you first. Like, who's the biggest threat out there to Milwaukee in the Eastern Conference?
I think they're kind of head and shoulders above everybody right now. I think they've gotten wins over the Lakers and Clippers, over top Western Conference teams. Giannis is playing. He's having an MVP caliber season. They obviously have the best record in the league. I think that if they didn't make the finals, it would be shocking.
Yeah, I mean, I would be surprised too if they didn't, Rohan. But you've still got the Eric Bledsoe factor, mm-hmm. where, you know, in the last two postseasons, Bledsoe was better than people gave credit for.
They made a mistake picking Bledsoe over Brogdon.
Yeah, if there's one thing I think that John Horst might want to do back, I'd have a do-over, is not give Bledsoe that extension, buy into Brogdon long-term more than Bledsoe. But Bledsoe kind of lurks out there, and there's no safety net with no Brogdon. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, George Hill's shooting like 87% of the career, absurd number, but he's not the two-way player.
Right, he's not the ball handler,
No, so I think there's pressure on Bledsoe there. And if I'm looking at potential threats, I do think there are real ones. I mean, Miami has gone to Milwaukee earlier in the season.
And won without Jimmy Butler.
Without Jimmy Butler, and they've improved. They add Iguodala. They mix and match there. I think they're better equipped to win that series as well. I think I'm skeptical about Boston against them because the size in the front court is still an issue. I think the Celtics would love to get their hands on a buyout
guy
in the next couple of weeks. But I'm still looking at Toronto and saying, like, the Raptors are sitting in second place right now. Like, and they are as equipped as any team to play against Milwaukee. They've got the size to match up. This is why they didn't make a deal at the trade deadline, because you've got Gasol and Ibaka. And if you're going to make an upgrade, whether it's Jrue Holiday or somebody else, you'd have to deal that contract. You'd have to move up with it. And you want to keep your size. You want to keep that front court intact. So you've got those two guys. Siakam, who before the injury was playing like an MVP. Kyle Lowry is just balling out right now. And some of these young guys that nobody's ever heard of have stepped into that player development program and are playing great. Like, just these second-round picks and undrafted guys who are becoming the Fred VanVleets of this year. So if I'm taking anybody, I'm taking Toronto at this point.
So the East is crazy to me because it's so kind of matchup dependent. I think based on like who could end up in the conference finals or the finals. Like, for example, I really like Boston. I think Boston's been flying under the radar just as much as Toronto in terms of like a contender. I mean, Boston, top 10 net rating. They've incredible defense, incredible. They've just been really good on both sides of the ball all year long. And that's with Gordon Hayward missing this big chunk of time. That's with a complete center by committee situation. But like you said, I just don't like their chance against Milwaukee. The Heat, well, I kind of like the Heat because people are going to immediately think I'm an idiot for this. But if I had to build a defender to try to slow down Giannis one-on-one, it would be someone similar to Bam Adebayo. I'm not saying he can do it or that it's not going to take a team effort, but that's where you start. You start with someone like him. The funny thing about Milwaukee is, as a whole, they're not a great three-point shooting team. They shoot a lot of them, and they have some guys who make a lot, other guys who don't. They just kind of kill you with volume, and they kill you with Giannis being so dominant in the paint. So I think if you can kind of muck up a series against them and maybe get hot from three, you'd have a chance. I think I'm lean Toronto or Miami in that situation. Toronto, man.
House money. Just sitting out there with house money.
And you have to imagine, if any team has confidence that they can slow down Giannis in a playoff series, it's Nick Nurse and the Raptors, right? You know, as long as Nick Nurse is not coaching like he was in the All-Star game.
Let's hold the All-Star game against him. Let's do that.
But in all seriousness, I think they must have some confidence that, can we get some facsimile of the defense we played last year against Giannis? I mean, obviously it's going to be a lot more difficult without Kawhi Leonard, but they probably feel like they might have something resembling the formula. So this isn't to say I think Boston is very good. I want to qualify that. I think that they are probably the second best team in the East. But if I'm going matchup-wise, I think Toronto or Miami could give Milwaukee a little bit more trouble.
Yeah, Boston's got the firepower. It's just I think they get overwhelmed physically against that team and without home
court. The problem with Boston is, outside of like Houston, there's not a great matchup for them to play their best five players together, which is, you know, Hayward, Brown, Tatum, Kemba, and Marcus.
No, I think they were hoping that Tristan Thompson got bought out and wanted to sign there, or even Jan Mahimi in Washington got bought out and you wanted to sign there. That didn't happen, and now they're kind of left with, you know, guys have overachieved. I think Daniel Tice is one of the more improved players in the NBA, but smallish center, Cantor limited defensively, Grant Williams a rookie, so it's not great.
If they had like Ed Davis, I'd be like, oh man, the Celtics. Like, they just need
even
that.
Mahimi. Like, Mahimi's it's been overpaid in recent years, but he's versatile and he has great numbers against Joel Embiid. Like,
right.
Whenever Like, he stinks against a lot of guys, but whenever Miami plays Embiid, for some reason, he plays really well. On Embiid, real quick, none of us mentioned Philadelphia as a potential threat, which is remarkable given that where we were 6 months ago.
They have played Milwaukee well.
They have, but Melissa, we talked earlier about dysfunction and not liking each other. That's a team that doesn't appear to have any kind of chemistry playing there. And, you know, Al Horford is now the most expensive reserve in NBA history. And I don't know if you can unring that bell. Like, I think when you put Horford on the bench, you've now kind of, you know, set a precedent there. I mean, I think the biggest question now is not can Philadelphia win a championship, is this the end of the current Sixers? Because they don't have a lot of room this summer to make kind of fringy upgrades. They're tied with like $120 million with their starting five. The only thing you can do is break up Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. I mean, if this team bows out in the first round, should Philadelphia break up Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid?
I don't think so. They're, what, 23 and 25? They're young guys. They'll figure it out. They're incredible defenders. They just need a little more time to figure out on the offensive end. I think that can also be adjusted with the pieces around them because, obviously, they both clog up the middle. You know, sitting Horford helps fix that problem a little bit. I think just give them a little time. They're not going to get better pieces. So I think they need to work with what they've got, and with maturity will come an improvement there.
Well, I don't disagree, Rohan, with the idea that a different supporting cast would be useful to them, because it still is remarkable to me that a Kawhi Leonard shot that bounced around the rim four times caused this team to break everything up, right? Like,
I mean, Embiid, like, if he played five more minutes that series, his plus-minus was absurd.
Right, yeah. But, like, I mean, if that shot doesn't go in for Kawhi,
right,
maybe they go to overtime, maybe Philadelphia wins, maybe they beat Milwaukee, hell, maybe they beat the Durantless Warriors in the finals, and we're not sitting here having this conversation, so right. I get that. But they kind of cast their lot with this group. Like, Al Horford is almost the definition of untradeable at this point, given how much money he's going to make on the back end of that deal and how old he's going to be. There's no real market for Josh Richardson or
Tobias Harris
at this point. You're not going to trade Tybalt because he's such a cheap player and brings such value as a role player. They could have brought Redick back. He wanted to come back. They could have brought Jimmy Butler back. He wanted to get paid. They chose not to. So now here they are. And I don't know. I mean, like, you know, kind of seems like your argument's kind of like Ben Simmons will get better. I'm not sure. Like, how many years he had now to develop a perimeter shot? Like, it's just not there. And, like, he is one of my favorite players. Like, if you could just exclude that weakness, he's one of my favorite players to watch because he gets up and down, defends five positions, but he has been begged all season long to shoot three-pointers. Like, the GM has begged, the coach has begged, Embiid is passively aggressive, like, said stuff.
Yeah, I shoot threes because, you know, we need yay.
You got to do, like, and he won't do it, so I don't know. I think if this team gets spanked in the first round by a Boston or Toronto, I think you got to pull the plug.
You'd move Simmons or Embiid?
I'd move Simmons. I think Embiid's the one, I think, with like even more upside that can be unlocked. Yeah. I'm not sure that the jump shot for Simmons is going to be unlocked. I mean, you guys see it in L.A. with Rondo. I used to wonder all the time when Rondo was in Boston, like, will he come back one summer like Michael Redd did, you know, and just all of a sudden have this three-point shot? He never did. Some guys just don't and are able to have really good careers without it. I just wonder if that's what Simmons thinks.
What's crazy about Philly is I think you could argue the last 3 years they've had like a choice between two doors and they've always opened the wrong one. Like, you could make an argument they never should have broken up the team that had Covington and Saric on it. That starting five was great. Then next year they have the Jimmy Butler one and it's really good. It's really, really good. And then they break it up and now they have this one that's the worst of the three. Like, they've just gotten worse and worse lineups each 3 years. So there's some proof that Simmons and Embiid can work together, right? Like, it's not, to me, a categorical failure. The problem is, like you said, they're both always going to have this artificial ceiling placed on them when they're playing with the other. Like, they can be really good together, but I don't think each of them individually can be their best together. I don't know that they need to blow it up. Here's the thing. I think they can keep Simmons and Embiid. I know that Horford and Harris probably don't have great trade markets. If you can accept that you aren't going to get the equal value for them back in a vacuum, but understand that you might be making a addition by subtraction move for your team because you're getting rid of a logjam or you're getting a better fit. If the front office can swallow that pill and that means trading Al Horford, you know, for someone who's not as good as him but helps your offense, then I do think there's a path for them to make this work with both of those guys. As someone who is selfish, I want to see Joel Embiid post up like 30 times a game, not 12 times a game. Yeah. And I want to see Ben Simmons play with four shooters. I want to see him run up and down the floor to the point where, like what Houston is doing, right, with Russell Westbrook, where he doesn't have to be the guy that has a three-point shot.
I want Ben Simmons to play with four shooters. Like, I want a pony. Like, that's the – they don't have four shooters.
But my point is that I want to see them split up for selfish reasons is what I'm saying. And I think – but I do think that there is a pathway for them to make it work together. It's just – it's very delicate. And I don't think they have it right now.
I think they lost that pathway when they made all the moves this offseason. I don't think you can get more than 50 cents on the dollar for Horford this summer. Maybe Harris is – I think there's interest in Harris a little bit, but I just don't see it. I think if this team gets spanked – and by the way, I'm not here for the Brett Brown slander either. Like, I mean, Brett Brown is not like Red Auerbach out there on the floor, but there's only so much a coach can do when nobody can shoot it. Like,
also, there's only so much a coach can do when every few months you're drastically changing his roster.
I know. Every year you're overhauling.
Right? Last year he dealt with multiple overhauls in the middle of the season and was expected to – I don't know. I personally feel bad for Brett Brown, but I also do think that he doesn't necessarily have the support of all the players who've come through there, and that does mean something.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. Let me finish with this. As we record this Tuesday morning out in Los Angeles, we still don't know the future of John Beilein in Cleveland. Multiple reports over All-Star Weekend said he was considering stepping down as head coach. Multiple reports in The Athletic and ESPN saying that even if he doesn't step down now, he's done after the season. Rowan, I don't see how John Beilein can coach this team in their first game back this weekend. I don't see it. Like, you keep using this phrase, but you can't unring this bell. Like, yeah. you have told your team, who already had issues respecting you and didn't think that you were the right guy anyway, you've told this team you thought about quitting. Like, and you're basically a lame duck for the end of the season. I don't know how he comes back after all that.
Bro, I don't know how he came back after the Thugs Slugs controversy. Yeah. That was wild. I mean, listen, I don't know what he said or what his intentions were or whatever. And I don't want to sound like the guy who is like, I knew it all along. But how old is John Beilein? Like, he's in his 60s, right?
67, 66. Something like that.
You hire a 66-year-old guy who's been in college his entire career, and, like, you really think this is the move? Like, this is going to work? Like, it just never really made sense to me. I mean, in some level, I guess I was happy for him just because he's, like, had a successful college career, wanted to give the NBA thing a try. But this was the wrong team to do it with. It was, like, still had a lot of veterans with some young guys who needed to play, like, this was just such a messy situation from the start. I agree. I mean, there's no way. There's just no way he can still coach this team. And, like, everyone involved here would be better off if he just walked away.
Oh, I agree. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember a college coach coming to the NBA who's had such a rebuilding task ahead of them. I mean, he had such a tall task ahead of him.
Right, and it wasn't even like he could come in, though, and know that he was going to rebuild. Because it was like Kevin Love is still on the roster.
Right, right. And yeah. On top of that, he's used to colleges, which, what, practice 4 days a week at minimum? In the NBA, you get one practice if
maybe,
you're lucky.
Yeah.
So he just had a really, really high hill ahead of him, and he couldn't do it. And I think he's miserable. I think the players are miserable. I think it's just broken at this point.
Yeah, I think you mentioned the rebuilding task. I think that was kind of the appeal in bringing him in at first, because the assumption was that you would get off Kevin Love, Tristan Thompson expiring, but Tristan Thompson's still young enough that you could grow, but you have guys that are, you know, around that college age, whether it's Darius Garland or Colin Sexton or any of the number of young guys they have there, and that maybe they would gravitate towards a coach that has the same style they've been used to, you know, for all those years in college. That, I mean, I could have told you that doesn't work. I mean, I was, you know, working for the Celtics when Rick Pitino was there, and Rick Pitino quite literally had, like, his Kentucky team there. He had Antoine Walker, Walter McCarty, Tony Delk, a bunch of guys from UK, and they didn't want to play for him. Like, he just, you know, once they became pros and started making money and understood the pro lifestyle and the 82-game season, it's a different mindset. The only kind of college coaches that work are coaches that can understand that and have, I guess, respect for that kind of process. I mean, Brad Stevens is the greatest example of it, and Brad got it right away and figured it all out. I'm actually a little bit surprised Billy Donovan's been as successful as he has, because Billy is kind of cut from that, you know, ultra competitive college
casino
coaching.
Cloth, quite there.
I mean, he won a couple national championships in Florida. But he's adapted, I think, really well to the NBA. But it is like a, I'm making this number up, but like a 90% failure rate. I mean, you, off the top of our heads, we can name college coaches that have failed with Rick Pitino or Calipari or Mike Montgomery or Lon Kruger or Eric Musselman. Like, although Eric was an assistant in the NBA. It just happens all the time. And the college coaches that succeed, they're just so few and far between. I just never understood it. Like, you have, Beilein has no professional experience. He wasn't an assistant coach in the NBA. You are bringing a 60-something-year-old coach to, it was almost like, and if you're Beilein, you're like, you know, college basketball is a cesspool. I can, you know, get out of here, get a 5-year, you know, retirement deal, all guaranteed, and,
right,
you know, try my hand at NBA coach, right, like fantasy camp.
And it's also not even like he was like a renowned tactician or like there's some,
No, he was, look, he was a very good college coach, which all these college coaches that go to the NBA are, but no ability or history of coaching at this particular level. And I don't know whose call it was. I don't know if it was Dan Gilbert's call. I mean, you know, Dan Gilbert's obviously from the area, you know, Rocket Mortgage and all that, Michigan, hiring a Michigan coach, Kobe Altman. What is his liability and all this? That's another part of the story. Like, does Kobe Altman survive all this? I mean, it's not just the hiring and eventual firing of John Beilein. It's like, I mean, I don't know that Colin Sexton, like, they traded Kyrie Irving for Colin Sexton, basically. And I don't know that he is, you know, worth that kind of investment. Darius Garland, still too soon to tell on Darius Garland. I think they need to split those guys up. They need to stop playing them together. I don't think that really works. But, you know, this is a kind of a hit for Kobe Altman, I think, as well there.
Yo, shout out to Billy Donovan, by the way. You mentioned him earlier. He's been in the NBA for like 4 years. He's seen a lot of stuff.
See a lot of crap.
A lot
Durant,
of stuff.
Westbrook.
Durant, Westbrook, Paul George, Carmelo Anthony. Shout out to Billy Donovan, man.
Yo, they love Billy in Oklahoma City. Yeah. Like
isn't he in the final year of his deal?
I don't know if it's. I think I they're very secretive about some of those deals.
Right.
Anyways,
okay.
That's the thing, though. That's why it's so crucial right at the beginning to win players' respect. Once you lose their respect, I don't know if that's something you can get back.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of across the board in any field that you're in. Like, your first impression, your first year, whether you build a good reputation for yourself, whether you gain people's respect, it's really, really tough to come back from it when you go the opposite way.
I gained Mannix's respect right away.
That's negative true at this point. I don't know. I think, you know, again, we're recording this on Tuesday. I think it's a pretty good chance Beilein's gone before the weekend. And, you know, they go to the coach they probably should have gone with to begin with, J.B. Bickerstaff.
I have to imagine the only thing holding that up is, like, are you going to pay this guy?
Well, that's the thing, too. I mean, like, Beilein, I think, was making, like, close to $4 million at Michigan. Ooh. He had to have gotten, like, this is part of the problem with, like, even if you like
how
these coaches.
How many coaches are the Cavs paying, man?
But no, but in a greater sense, like, even if you like these college coaches, you've got to overpay to get them to the NBA because of how much money the top-level guys are making at college basketball on lifetime contracts. Mm-hmm. So you've got to give them 5-year deals at $5 million per season just to get them out of the college ranks. It is bonkers out there. So, I mean, I'm with you. 4.5 years left on that deal at probably close to $5 million. I'm just guessing on that number. I don't know off the top of my head, but close to $5 million per year. That's a tough pill for an NBA coach to swallow. All right, guys, thank you for joining me here in studio. Good to be here with you, Melissa, Rohan, you know, whatever. We're okay.
Thanks, Chris.
Read all Melissa's stuff, Lakers coverage over at SI.com. Rohan, what are you doing these days? What do we got? What do we got going on with you?
We got two stories coming out this week.
Two stories.
Yeah, there we go.
Are you
baby.
Writing any more about your best friend, Dwayne Wade?
I am, yeah. His jersey's getting retired this week. I had a chance to pre-screen his documentary.
Did you ask to be like the Dwayne Wade maven? Is that what you wanted to
do? Yes, I did. I asked
Even
Dwayne
if
Wade,
he's retired?
That's right. I asked why I wasn't in the documentary. You know, I thought I'd put in the hours, put in the work, but, you know, maybe the sequel.
Someday I want to love someone or something like you love Dwayne Wade.
I hope you get to feel that. I really do.
Okay. All right. Thanks for joining me, guys.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.